just one more chapter left, which is the female version of the reproductive system. We've already talked about it a little bit in the male chapter when we compared the two. The female reproductive system has a longer list of functions, right? As we talked about. But keep in mind that the two sexes are indistinguishable for several weeks in the embryonic stage, right? It just depends on which of those ducts develops, either the paramesonephric duct or the mesonephric duct, as we've already talked about. So here we're looking at the adult reproductive anatomy for a female. And one thing about animals is that they don't have the same number of openings from species to species and from sex to sex within the species. For instance, a bird has one passageway for three different systems: reproductive system, urinary system, and digestive system, all empty through the same hole, which we call a cloaca, which means sewer. So, feces, urine, and eggs all come out the same passageway. In female humans, on the other hand, there are separate openings for each of these three. So there's a urethra, of course, emptying the urinary bladder. That's its own dedicated passageway. Doesn't share that with anything else. There's the anus leading from the digestive tract, of course. That's its own dedicated passageway. And then the vagina is a passageway only for the reproductive system. By the way, the urethra and the anus are outlets. The vagina is a two-way street, really, because it serves to receive the penis and therefore the semen from the penis. And if that goes well, and in terms of reproduction intent and fertilization takes place, then a zygote results, an embryo develops from the zygote, a fetus develops from the embryo, all of this happening in the uterus, and then eventually the vagina comes into play as an exit, because the endoparasite, or the fetus, needs to be ejected. So that's different even from a male human, right? A male human only has two of these three openings, because one of them is shared by two different organ systems. What am I talking about specifically? Yeah, the urethra in a male is a common passageway for both the urinary system and the reproductive system. Urine and semen both exit through the urethra. Okay, so this is obviously a median section, so we're looking right at the a section going through the midline of the body. And so we're looking at her right half from inside. And notice that the uterus, which is where an embryo and fetus live if they are created, is a muscular pouch-like organ that in the anatomical position tilts anteriorly and lies superior to the urinary bladder. This is the urinary bladder. So the urinary bladder undergoes changes in size, of course. Fills up and then gets emptied, fills up and gets emptied. The uterus also can undergo quite a change in size. So what we're looking at here is a non-pregnant uterus, which is not very big, about 10 centimeters at its longest part. But obviously it gets much bigger than that if pregnancy occurs. And if pregnancy occurs during the late weeks of pregnancy, that fetus takes up the majority of the volume of the abdominal pelvic cavity, which means everything else just needs to be shoved away to the side. And that's why, for instance, a pregnant woman will feel like she has a full bladder all the time. She doesn't. It's just that the fetus pressing on the bladder makes it gives her the same stretch reflex sensations as she would get if the bladder were full. The uterus, by the way, begins where the vagina ends. So the vagina is a passageway. What did I say that means? Vagina? I told you. It means sheath. Right? Like the sheath of a sword. The sword is the penis. You put the sword in its sheath, the vagina. And so it's a passageway to and from the uterus. The uterus is a dead end in terms of it being a space. But that space is really just a potential space in a non-pregnant uterus. So a non-pregnant uterus is flattened. There's no space in there that, you know, the epithelia lining on both sides come together. So there really is no space there, or not very much space. But anyway, it's a dead end if you were trying to travel up through this. Attached to the uterus, though, on either side, and so we're only seeing one half of it, is a tube, a duct, that can be called the uterine tube. That's the modern day usage. Uterine tubes, though, can be called by any of two other names. What do you know them as otherwise? Fallopian tubes, named after an Italian guy that's been dead for hundreds of years. And what's still another name for the fallopian tubes are uterine tubes. Oviducts. Oviducts are pretty good names because it tells you what they do. They are passageways for eggs or ova that get created and released from the ovaries, right? So each uterine tube is associated with an ovary that lies close to the open end of this uterine tube. Well, actually, both ends are open. One end of the uterine tube, though, is connected directly to the lumen of the uterus. So the uterine lumen, which is where the fetus develops, that space is continuous with the beginning of the uterine tube. But the other end of the uterine tube is also an open end. It actually opens directly into the peritoneal space in the abdominal pelvic cavity. And it flares open like the bell of a horn and has fringe-like projections called fimbriae. That's the plural of fimbria. That lie close to the ovary. They're not actually directly connected to the ovary, but the fimbriae partially surround the ovary, and in terms of this operating as a reproductive system, the funnel-like opening at this end of the uterine tube, where these fimbriae are, will hopefully collect the ovum or egg that gets burst through the side of the ovary during ovulation. But that doesn't have to happen. Sometimes an ovulated egg will just end up in the peritoneum and not make it into the uterine tube, which makes it less likely for sperm to ever reach it. But it actually is possible for sperm to swim all the way through the vagina, through the uterus, through the uterine tube, into the peritoneum, where it encounters an egg that didn't get collected into the tube. And you can have, that's one example of an ectopic pregnancy. But often the ovulated egg will make it into this funnel-like uterine tube and be swished along by the action of cilia that are beating in synchrony and that are on the cells lining the endothelium of the uterine tube to bring this egg some distance through the uterine tube toward the uterus. That's where normal pregnancy occurs. I mean, that's where normal fertilization occurs. The sperm, in other words, if they are successful in fertilizing an egg, they will find that egg somewhere along this length of the uterine tube. They swim up into the uterine tube, encounter the egg. One of those sperm will be the lucky one that will inject its chromosomes into the egg to make it the zygote. That's where fertilization occurs, but that's not where implantation occurs, right? So the fertilized egg, or the zygote, more correctly, because it's really no longer an egg at that point, continues to migrate, and it will eventually embed in the endothelium that lines the uterus itself, and that's where development will proceed. So it would also be considered an ectopic pregnancy if implantation occurs in the uterine tube, which is not nearly equipped as well as the uterus to house this enlarging thing. Just like the male, the female has primary and secondary sex organs. What are the primary organs? We've already talked about this as well. Primary sex organs of the female? The ovaries, right. They're primary because they are the ones that produce the gametes, just like the testes were the primary sex organs in the male. So everything else is secondary. And you can also think about this in terms of external genitalia and internal genitalia. We'll get a better look at the external genitalia from a different view, but we can see here that there's a fairly thick pad of mostly adipose tissue between the pubic bones, one on either side of the pubic symphysis. This is a median plane, so the symphysis is labeled here. That's where the two bones come together, right? That's just, the pubic symphysis is just a line, but on either side of that are pubes, the two pubes or pubic bones. And that's where this pad of fat lies, which we call the mons pubis, which is just padding for intercourse, because this is a bony underlying. It gives padding for intercourse. And on the mons pubis is where most of the pubic hair in a female occurs, but there's also hair occurring on the labia majora, which is the plural of labium majus, meaning larger lip. There are two pairs of lips in the external female genitalia. Labium minus is the singular of labia minora. The smaller, hairless lips and the labia majora are the larger, fatter, and partially hair-covered lips. We'll get another view of those in a minute. There's also shown here half of the clitoris, and when we look at it from the front, you can see that it actually has a Y-shaped arrangement. But from this cutaway view, you can see that the clitoris is very similar in structure to what part of the penis? What's it look like? Corpus cavernosum. Well, there are two of them, right? Two corpora cavernosa. Same thing in the clitoris. Clitoris does not have a spongy urethra. I mean, it doesn't have a corpus spongiosum. And the clitoris isn't involved with the urethra at all. But other than that, it's very much like the penis. It has two erectile columns, the two corpora cavernosa instead of three, not involved in urination at all, but is where the highest concentration of sensory receptors for sexual excitement are centered, just like in the glands of the penis. And just like the penis, the clitoris is erectile. All right, let's go to the second slide, which is a close-up of an ovary. So in a normal female, there's an ovary on either side, and the pink stuff surrounding this are those fimbriae, which are the fringes around the orifice of the uterine tube. The uterine tube is not part of the ovary, and like I said, it's not actually connected to it. It's just in that area, hoping to hoping that an ovulated oocyte, or egg, or ovum, they all mean the same thing basically, will make it into the lumen of the uterine tube. But inside the ovary itself, well, the ovary is encapsulated, just like the testis is. And in fact, that fibrous connective whitish outer covering has the same name, whether it's testis or ovary. Do you remember the name? Without looking, that's not remembering it, that's reading. What was it called? Not terminal, not germinal, not terminal, whichever one of those you're saying. Tunica albuginea, right? The white coat. Remember, alb means white. Tunica albuginea is that fibrous connective tissue covering of either the ovary or the testis. Same name. But inside that, in other words, the main thickness of the ovary is actually another example of an organ that has a cortex and a medulla. And what is always the relationship between cortex and medulla? Medulla is deeper, cortex is more superficial. So you don't really see a real distinct boundary between medulla and cortex. But the medulla, the deepest part, is mostly connective tissue with vessels. The middle part of this figure, where you see the blood vessels here, that's the cortex. The medulla. The cortex surrounds that, so it's the part just deep to the tunica albuginea, the cortex is. And the cortex also consists of connective tissue, but that's where you also find follicles. And follicles are shown here. These large ones are just exaggerated. There are originally millions of what are called primordial follicles. And by originally, I mean before the female that owns this ovary is born. So females have their follicles produced in their ovaries already before they are born, and those start developing in terms of meiosis, and we'll get to this later, before birth, and then it pauses for, in some cases, many decades. Depends on when that follicle, if ever, gets chosen as the one that will eventually release an egg. By far, the majority of follicles die. In fact, most of them die before that female is even born, leaving still many more than she needs for a lifetime of releasing them, on average one per 28 days, especially considering there are two ovaries and they kind of ping pong. So one ovary will release an oocyte or egg, the other one will next time. It keeps going back and forth. It's not true of all women, of course. Some drop two eggs at once, which is why some women can have multiple sets of twins. But anyway, this is totally different from how this happens in males. First of all, males don't even start their meiosis or gamete production until well after birth, and actually in adolescence it starts. But it's a start-to-finish operation all at once. It doesn't pause or anything. And so sperm are made fresh daily by the millions, whereas there's only, on average, one egg per month, roughly, that is produced in females. And those all are already old. Those are just, you know, each one is a chosen cell from this small population that actually started out before the female was even born. So that's another major difference between males and females. And we'll talk about that process probably in the next lecture. But anyway, in terms of these follicles, a follicle contains what will eventually be called an egg. It contains an oocyte in some form. There are different oocytes that we'll distinguish later. But a follicle itself is that oocyte plus surrounding cells. And what surrounds the oocyte, whatever kind of oocyte it is, depends on what kind of follicle, which is determined by what stage in the maturation of those follicles we're in. And so we can just see examples of each of these just to give you these terms, but we'll revisit these later. The primordial follicles are the youngest ones. Those are what a female fetus has the most of. She'll lose most of those, like I said. Most of them will die before she's even born. Those then can develop, and they don't all develop at once. Some get chosen to develop into primary follicles first, which can then go on to secondary follicles, tertiary follicles, and then finally a mature follicle, which is the better word. We can also call these, though, Graafian follicles, G-R, this is an eponym, so it's capitalized usually, G-R-A-A-F-I-A-N. Graafian and mature follicles are the same thing. But a mature follicle is a follicle that's developed to the point that it is the chosen one for that cycle, and it will release its egg in ovulation, the process of ovulation, through the surface, the exterior surface of the ovary. It explodes, basically. It's an eruption of an egg through this tunica albuginea. And a mature follicle, before that happens, will actually cause a bump to appear on the tunica albuginea, the outer surface of this ovary, that eventually explodes. And like I said, sometimes that explosion will send the egg off just into the fluid that fills the peritoneal cavity and not be collected by the uterine tube, but often it does get collected by the uterine tube. Now you can see here on the left side an ovarian ligament attached at one end of the ovary, and at the other end a suspensory ligament. Just keep those in mind when we look at, I think, probably the next picture. Yeah, slide 3. So now we can see a more overall view. We've zoomed out, in other words. The picture we just looked at is just like her right ovary, the one on the left side of the picture here. And is that correct? Which side was the suspensory ligament on the last one? Okay, so this one is actually the ovary we just looked at is like the one on the right in this picture, which would be her left. Okay? The suspensory ligament is a ligament that is called that because it suspends suspends the ovary. The ovary hangs from it. But the suspensory ligament is one of several ligaments that keep this thing in place. The suspensory ligament, though, connects the lateral side of the ovary to the body wall. Okay, but notice that it's also a route for blood vessels. Ovarian artery and vein run through the suspensory ligament. The medial side of the ovary has the ovarian ligament connected to it, so named because, of course, it's connected to the ovary, but the other end of that ovarian ligament is connected to the uterus. Now, the ovarian ligament is actually just part of this overall huge, flat band of connective tissue. And this this huge band is actually part of the peritoneum. What is the peritoneum an example of? No, I'm asking, what is the peritoneum an example of? It is tissue, yes, but what is a specific example of what? A serous membrane, right. So the peritoneum is the major serous membrane in the abdominal pelvic cavity. So its layers cover many of the abdominal pelvic organs, right? Not all of them. Some of them lie behind the peritoneum, like the kidneys, which is why we call those retroperitoneal. So this whole big flap of tissue, that's actually just part of the overall peritoneum. But it's serving as a ligament. It's actually serving as several named ligaments, depending on which part of it you're in. So the widest part holds the uterus in place, and extend. There's one on the other side as well. You're just only seeing it on the right side of this figure. The widest part is attached to the lateral side of the uterus, and then extends over to the body wall, and that is called the broad ligament. Not broad meaning woman, broad meaning wide. It's the widest part here. So the ovarian ligament is actually continuous with that. All right? But you can see it as a fold in this, what would otherwise be the broad ligament. Then, superior to the ovary and ovarian ligament is another flat part that, notice here, is labeled the mesosalpinx. Now, salpinx here means trumpet, and meso means middle. So this means the middle of the trumpet. Well, the overall uterine tube, or fallopian tube, or oviduct, is kind of trumpet-shaped because of the flaring that I was talking about where you see the fimbriae. So the whole thing kind of looks like a trumpet, and therefore the ligament that attaches to the middle part of this trumpet is the mesosalpinx. But it's also part of this overall flat piece of peritoneum. Okay, the divider between mesosalpinx and broad ligament is the ovarian ligament. Now, the mesovarium is also part of the peritoneum, but you don't really see that in the big picture. Up on B, though, at the upper right, you can see the mesovarium labeled. And notice that we're now looking at it from this side. Okay? So this picture, this plane that you see right here, we're looking at that plane this way when we're looking at B. And so that mesovarium is a kind of a shelf of tissue that extends forward from this vertical shelf that we just called mesosalpinx and broad ligament. Right, so the mesovarium is like this part of my hand. This would be the mesosalpinx. This would be the broad ligament. All right, that holds the uterus. I mean, that holds the ovary in place with respect to the uterus, and it also holds the uterus in place. The uterus itself. Before I forget, talk about the uterine tubes first. The uterine tube has three major subdivisions to it. I've already talked about the fimbriae. Those are just the finger-like fringes, which is what fimbria means, fringe. But the fimbriae are arranged around the orifice that receives eggs, ovulated eggs from the ovaries, and that orifice is much enlarged. The diameter is much greater than it is for most of the length of the uterine tube. So that largest diameter funnel-like end of the uterine tube is the infundibulum, which means what? Funnel, right. It's the funnel-shaped part of the uterine tube. That's the. You can think of it as the first part in terms of the direction of the egg. The egg enters at the infundibulum, if it enters at all. And then the next part, which is between the... It's three serially arranged parts. The next, or middle part, is the ampulla. And then finally that gives rise to the narrowest diameter part, which is the isthmus, which is why it's called that, right? An isthmus is a narrowing. That isthmus then connects directly to the uterus. So if we look at the interior of the uterus, notice that it is fairly thick-walled. And the thickness of that wall is broken into three parts, kind of like the heart was, right? The outer part, meaning the superficial part, is the perimetrium. The inner part is the endometrium, and then sandwiched between those two is the myometrium. Now, what do you suppose the metri part of myometrium, endometrium, and perimetrium means? What is it? Uterus, yes. Means uterus. So the perimetrium literally means around the uterus. Well, it's actually part of the uterus. It is serous membrane. It's a serosa. Okay? The endometrium, what kind of tissue is that? It's the inner lining. Lining. Epithelium, right. And then between those two, the thickest by far of the three is the myometrium. And what does myo mean? Muscle. So the uterus is a highly muscularized organ, but the thickness of that muscle can drastically change. The thickness of the muscle changes within a reproductive cycle, within one uterine cycle. The overall reproductive cycle has two components to it in a female. There's the uterine cycle, and there is the ovarian cycle. This is actually, by the way, this is another big difference between males and females. They use basically the same hormones, but in drastically different ratios. So they both have masculine and feminine hormones, but in a female, it's a greater ratio of feminine to masculine, versus in a male, it's mostly masculine, less feminine hormones. But the big difference, I mean, the bigger difference still, other than the ratios, is that hormones in a male are fairly constant in the level they occur, the concentrations they occur in the blood. You know, so once testosterone starts being secreted in bulk at puberty, it stays fairly high level. But in a female, hormones undergo ups and downs. It's a very cyclic secretion of hormones, more of which we'll get into later, but that's definitely different from how it is in a male. So female reproductive system is conspicuously cyclic, including a uterine cycle and an ovarian cycle. And the uterine cycle sees changes in the thickness of the myometrium even in a non-pregnant uterus. But if pregnancy does occur, the pregnant uterus undergoes a drastically greater increase in myometrial thickness. So it gets more muscular as those muscles become necessary, basically, which is the muscles really become necessary to expel the fetus in parturition or childbirth. The overall uterus I called kind of dead-ended in the first slide. Here we're looking at it from the front. And so the dead end is really the superior most part of it, although the uterus changes positions depending on what's happening. So the top part of this figure actually is often tilted anteriorly over the urinary bladder. But anyway, that top part in this figure of the uterus, the dead end of the uterus, is called the fundus for the same reason that the fundus of the stomach was called that, right? Remember I said that the fundus is the part of an urn that is situated opposite the open end. So on an urn, it would be the part that you sit on the pedestal. It's away from the open end. Same is true here. This is like an upside-down urn, and the fundus is the closed end. That's the biggest part of it in terms of width. And then the open end is the inferior part. So the overall uterus is roughly triangular in shape, an upside down triangle. So there are points on the right and left at the top, and there's one point at the bottom. The points at the right and left at the top correspond to where the two uterine tubes connect to the uterus. The point on the bottom represents the opening to and from the uterus, which is called what part of the uterus? It's also a narrowing because of that triangular shape. What is it called? The cervix, which means what? Neck, right. So this is my cervix. You know, cervix means narrowing. A neck is a narrowing. It's narrower than my head or my torso, so that this is a cervix. Well, the cervix of the uterus is the narrowest part in terms of the what's happening in that lumen elsewhere in the uterus. So it's the cervix that features the cervical canal, which is just the space within the narrowing. The cervical canal is the space that connects directly the lumen of the uterus to the lumen of the vagina. And notice that the vagina, the space within the vagina, not only communicates directly with the cervical canal, but also has pouches that extend on either side of the cervix of the uterus. And so these are called fornices, lateral fornices. Fornices is F-O-R-N-I-C-E-S, but that's just the plural of fornix, meaning vault. So these are just dead ends in the vagina that do not lead directly to the uterus, but to either side of it. The cervical canal itself, which is just the part of the cervical lumen that forms this narrow passageway through the actual narrowing, which is the cervix itself, has two ends. The tunnel has, it's like a tunnel. There's two ends to the tunnel. The one that leads directly to the main opening of the uterus in the body of the uterus is the internal os, which means mouth, whereas the one that leads directly to or from the vagina is the internal os, external os, which it's just the two ends of the tunnel, the two ends of the cervical canal. Oh, before I leave this, I just wanted to say that not only does the thickness of the myometrium, the muscular part of the uterine wall, go up and down with each cycle or with pregnancy, it's also true that how muscular the organ is changes from where you are in the uterus. The most muscular part is on the fundus end. And then as you move toward the cervix, there's still muscle in there, but there's more and more connective tissue along with the muscle. And by the time you get to the cervix, it's all connective tissue pretty much and no muscle there. And this makes sense, of course, right? Because the muscle is there to expel the fetus. That happens from the fundus pushing it toward the cervix because the cervix is where it's going to exit. In four, well, this is just a close-up of the endometrium, which is the inner lining of the uterine wall. So this is, we can see the epithelial cells right there at the free surface. And these also drastically undergo changes, cyclic changes. So the endometrium, its importance really is only during pregnancy. If the uterus, if pregnancy does not occur, the uterus is really doing nothing, right? The hormones that are important for things other than reproduction, those are coming from the ovaries, not from the uterus. So the uterus, it undergoes changes each cycle to prepare itself for doing the only job it's good for, which is to house, for there to be implantation of an embryo, for further development into a fetus. That's what the uterus is for. So each cycle, roughly every 28 days, the uterus undergoes changes that will prepare this endometrial lining to be the perfect environment for a developing embryo first and then eventually fetus. And so not only do the myometrial cells undergo changes, but more drastically the epithelial cells of the endometrium undergo changes in their thickness with respect to a layer. So there, we'll talk more about this in a different slide as well, but there is a so-called functional layer that is an increase in thickness that will occur each cycle, but then be eliminated. And when that is eliminated, all of the debris that results will be discharged as menstrual fluid. So the menstrual cycle is part of the overall cyclicity of female reproductive physiology. Now to five. This isn't anatomically correct, by the way. This the aorta shown here should be on the midline, of course. It's not way off to the side. They only showed it this way just to so that they can show you how the connections are made between the main blood supply and the structures in the female reproductive anatomy that they're serving. So this aorta really should be right in line with the centrally placed uterus, and therefore these vaginal arteries and uterine arteries that we see here are not nearly that long. They don't have to travel that far to get to the uterus, which is right in front of the abdominal aorta, really. But notice there are vaginal arteries, or there's a vaginal artery, there's a uterine artery, and of course those are named for what they are supplying, right? The vaginal artery gives rise to many branches that send blood to the cells of the wall of the vagina. Similarly, the uterine artery supplies the cells of the uterine wall. But there's also ovarian arteries that branch off of uterine arteries coming through the suspensory ligament. And obviously the ovarian arteries are there to send blood to the cells that make up the interior of the ovary. Well, notice that this arrangement is an example of an anastomosis. Remember we talked about anastomoses in the circulatory system chapter? Do you remember anastomosis? It's not your standard situation. And in anastomosis, which is a web-like arrangement, you have blood coming from multiple places and coming together, the tubing comes together before it branches into capillaries, which is what you see here. Notice that there are arcuate arteries in the wall of the uterus, just like where else in the body? Kidneys, right. But that's the main point of this slide. We've talked about the overall anatomy. This is just how the blood gets there. By the way, the spiral arteries, which I didn't mention, which rise from the arcuate arteries, these spiral arteries also get created and destroyed. Each, or at least parts of them, get created and destroyed. They get longer during each cycle. And then if pregnancy does not occur, which means menstruation will occur, that along with that, well, part of that endometrial lining are blood vessels in the form of spiral arteries that serve those cells that get sloughed off, and so the vessels themselves get shorter. Now to six. So here we see the external genitalia in a female, which collectively can be called the vulva, which I think just means covering. Another name for the vulva, though, is pudendum. And you can tell that males came up with these names because that's a word that means shameful part. But that's rarely used. Vulva is kind of used. But female external genitalia is what we usually say anatomically in an anatomy and physiology class. Well, the vulva or external genitalia on a female is right where you would expect it to be, same place as in a male, namely in which diamond-shaped area? What is the diamond-shaped area that this is all occurring in called? It's the one that the points of the diamond are defined by bony landmarks, remember? On my self-portrait? Don't remember the name of it? Perineum. So the external genitalia are perineal in position. Well, the bony landmarks in a female are exactly the same as in a male. So perineum is defined for the same by those same four bony landmarks in a female. We already talked about the mons pubis, which is that mound of fat for padding, basically. That's where most of the pubic hair that develops at puberty forms. But some of the pubic hair also forms on the lateral sides of the two labia majora, which are larger lips, hence their name, but also fattier lips. They have a thicker layer, they have a layer of fat in them. And so there's an internal and a lateral and a medial surface to each labium majus. It's the lateral surface that has hair on it, not the medial surface. But that's distinct, that's different from the labia minora, which are much smaller, thinner lips that are entirely hairless. They also are different. The two sets of labia are different in that the labia majora are dry, whereas the labia minora are moist epithelium. Now, the space between the two labia minora, the two inner lips, so the width, the space defined by that width between those two labia majora, minora, is the vestibule, as you see labeled here. And so the vestibule, which itself is an opening or a space, contains the two orifices to two passageways, right? The urethral orifice leading from the urethra, because urethra is an outlet, and the vaginal orifice leading to and from the vagina. Now, the clitoris, in the external, and without dissecting, the only part of the clitoris that's visible is the head of the clitoris, or the glands, just like the gland, the same word as in glands of the penis. And that's where the highest concentration of sensory receptors are, but that's not the entire clitoris. That's just the part that's visible externally. That clitoris, though, is partially hooded by the female version of the prepuce. What does prepuce mean? We saw that in the male. What was it in the male? Foreskin. In the female, the prepuce is the place where the two labia minora meet superiorly. So each labium minus, which is the singular, come together at the top to cover the clitoris. Okay, I wanted to show you the other view of the clitoris on the bottom. So when you actually have a dissection and you can see the whole thing, you can see this Y-shaped arrangement of the clitoris. So the visible part would be like the vertical part of the Y. But if you go, that extends deeper into the body and then bifurcates. Well, remember, the overall clitoris is made up of two corpora cavernosa, right? And each one of those is half of the Y. So where it actually splits apart, and so you have two legs of it, those are called crura. Crura, C-R-U-R-A, is the plural of crus, which means leg. In fact, the leg, what we call the leg, is called the crus. Which, I'm sorry, I pointed to my thigh. That's not the leg. This is the crus. Anyway, they're called legs because they, because of this bifurcation. They're like the two legs of a body. The glands of the clitoris is just a continuation. So there's overall two corpora cavernosa, but the two come together to form the two halves of the glands of the clitoris. And also, if we look at it in dissection, we can see that there are glands associated with the part of the vagina surrounding the vagina, but close to the surface. And so there are periurethral glands, as you see here, called that because they're right next to the urethra. There are greater vestibular glands because they surround that vestibule, which I said was the space between the labia minora. And the bulb, which is labeled here, the vestibular bulb, is a ring of glandular tissue surrounding the vagina near the surface. All right? And that's probably all I can tell you about today. Yeah, we'll stop there.